accession number 27083, reel 25.
So you went to Guy's and ordered box spurs.
I ordered box spurs. And Guy's, very efficient, very helpful, as usual. They produced this, and that was all right. Unfortunately, a short while afterwards, it happened to be the first occasion after the issue of box spurs, because I judged that I really ought to hand them out to these distinguished officers, so that they got accustomed to putting them on and wearing them and riding in them. And this was the first occasion, this particular morning, that they had worn their box spurs. And the first I heard of it, because I didn't attend these rehearsals, and they didn't want me apart from anything else. And they had a mere 2.5 scrabbling round, seeing God Almighty was just not on. And at about 9 o'clock, I was rung up by the delightful but blasé old colonel from the Blues, who acted as sort of liaison officer for this Dalish Rod. And he was in a great state. And bit by bit, what emerged over the phone was, and he was most agitated, he said that apparently it was their first morning wearing their spurs, and they didn't really quite know what to do with their legs when they were wearing spurs. And the First Sea Lord, who was sort of well back in the line as opposed to the head of it, and he was sort of swinging his legs forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards, and so he was bored rigid, and he swung his legs a bit too far, and it had the effect of plunging his spurs into the flanks of his mount, which instantly, as horses do, you know, he leapt forward. And being passed by another horse, going some, all the other horses started to go like this, including the controllers. And he was in, this was Rafe Edwards, who was at the head of the line. And the Wee McGregor's horse flashed past, because they were just completing the first circuit, flashed past the entrance to the camp and disappeared into the distance, totally out of control. And Rafe Edwards knew perfectly well that he had to follow his senior officer, and so he made to go ahead and follow the Wee McGregor, but his horse decided that he would return to his stable and have his breakfast, and the two parted company. And Rafe Edwards, who was a great big man, very heavily built, he fell off and he landed on his head. And he momentarily passed out, but only momentarily. I mean, he wasn't seriously hurt or anything, but nevertheless, he had passed out. Fielded by this agitated colonel in the Blues, who had a flat quite close by, and what happened to the rest of them that morning, I don't know. And he got the controller into some vehicle and took him to his flat, and poured out a stiff glass of brandy and held it to the great man's lips, and then suddenly some little bit of first aid tweaked his memory about concussion and spirits and so forth. So he knocked the brandy back himself and put the kettle on to give the controller some tea. And the controller kept on emphasizing that he was quite all right, which is one of the earlier signs of concussion, I'm told. And he was aware of this. And at that point, he rang me up. So I went straight to J.Y. Thompson, the director of the Gunner Division, because it had transpired that the controller was being very difficult about being kept to rest in the flat for a moment longer, because he said he had an important meeting to chair at whatever it was, 9:30 that very morning, about what I didn't know, of course. But the director of the Gunnery Division did, and realized that it was an important meeting at which important decisions were to be taken. And so it was equally important that the decisions went the right way, and not by a man suffering from concussion. And so on. And so it went on. And it was, you know, it was all very remarkable. There were... I could go on forever, but I won't, except to say that I had the most splendid liaison with London District. And there was a man in the Air Force who acted as a sort of liaison officer, really to keep London District quiet, because all the work was going with it for the Air Force was going on in the outfield. And he was great fun to do business with as well, and so on. And, of course, having done Clapham, I then had to mark out Whitehall, which I did. That could only be done by night for obvious traffic reasons and so on. And the arithmetic was okay. so it had all been worthwhile. And I got all the marks in, and that was fine. And
was it the case that your planning for the dress, for the street layout of the dress rehearsal, seems to have been almost as torturous? I know you had these difficulties that Sunday,
yep.
But seems to have been almost as torturous and as time-consuming as planning for the real thing. Would that be the case or not?
Well, the two were really coincident, despite the disparity in geographical layout of the two sites. The pure distance measurement was the same, and you just had to ignore that you were going around the corner, in the case of Clapham, and so forth. And you had to get it right. And in particular, and I'm just coming on to showing the participants, the main participants, the West End stuff, rather than the Clapham stuff. And the day came, and we had a conference in the Admiralty, at which they were briefed. And at about this time, because this was getting fairly near the day, they appointed other people to do, I was about to say to do this work, but they didn't do any work. They appointed a charming rear admiral called Robin Durnford Slater. they appointed a captain who had been the gunnery officer of the Mauritius when I was there, and I think I told you about him when he went on with the ship into the Med, and he was the one who had that unfortunate collision with the Swift Jaw, and so forth. They appointed, he was the chief staff officer, they appointed a Royal Marines major and a flag lieutenant. But of course, and I don't say this boastfully at all, there was actually nothing for them to do. I mean, I sent the orders, which occupied an inch and a half foolscap book, down to Admiral Durnford Slater to sign when he was in his North Cornish cottage on leave from his previous appointment. And he dutifully signed them, and they were therefore ready for distribution and so on. And there was nothing for the others to do. But the idea was that we should stand in a huddle in Trafalgar Square and be there for the whole day, virtually. And that was all right. So they were present for the briefing, which was largely done by a man who occupied the post of Assistant Chief of the Naval Staff, who was one up on the director of the Gunnery Division. He was a rear admiral, and his name was, I think his name was Rolf. Can't remember. He was a rather odd personality. And Ivan Sal, the newly appointed chief staff officer, wouldn't let that sort of thing escape notice lightly. And he aptly referred to this chap immediately as hand-knitted from head to foot, which absolutely summed him up. Well, the briefing finished, and then it fell to me to take this team, and the team consisted of the battalion commanders, the company commanders, right down to the platoon commanders. So there was quite a gaggle of them, sailors and marines, officers, around the course in the West End. And we started, we came out of the Admiralty, and we started by Admiralty Arch to go across and down Northumberland Avenue. And we came to where the first mark should be, and it wasn't there. And so I resorted to that well-known gunnery precept. Well, I'm sorry about that, gentlemen, but for drill purposes only, that's where the mark will be on the day. We went on to the next one. And that wasn't there either. And my heart sank, and I didn't know what to do about this. And I drearily took them around the whole way down Northumberland Avenue and along the embankment and up Whitehall. And did I feel an ass, because there were none of the marks. And we had just got, we'd started to go up Whitehall, and we saw the reason. The Westminster City Council had laboriously looked up in a report from the previous coronation in 1937, which had evidently been an extremely hot day. And at the end of the day, when not so much the troops, but when the police who stood behind them came to move off, it was reported that their boots stuck to the melted tarmac. And so the City Council had ordered one of those road-making fiery furnace things to go the whole length of the route and burn off the surplus tarmac on the surface, and with it all my marks. And so I had to start again from scratch. It was tricky, and at about that time I'd always had trouble with my teeth. I'd had bad teeth as a small boy. When I was routinely taken to the dentist, my elder brother would have a sort of scrape round and get away with half an hour's brush up. I would have a nasty number of fillings and told to come back again and all the rest of it. And I'd had trouble with them. I'd had my wisdom teeth out, and I had got to the stage when I'd had a lot of other teeth out too. And I was fitted rather like a rabbit, with something like six up and six down in front, and the rest were on a denture. And one of these front teeth went sour. And I knew that with any luck, my next job would be a sea job. I had no time at all for naval dentists any more than I had for naval doctors. And the justification, I may say then, to be changed radically later, but not then. And the option was, if you were serving in the Admiralty, that you look down a list of consultants in Harley or Wimpole Street, and you pick one of your choice, and you made an appointment, and told them to send the bill to the Admiralty, and that was that. Which I did, and I went to some man whose name I can't recall. I think he was in Harley Street. And I went to him simply because he had more letters after his name on the list than anybody else. And when I got there, I found that he was a short, very tough, he was like a monkey, very tough, very sort of stalwart little man, of the sort that should really shave three times a day but didn't get around to it, and so on. And I told him my problem and said, I want them all out. I've had enough of this. And he argued the toss and said that it was absurd. I'd be mad to have them all out. I had to leave one as an anchor and all that stuff. And I said, I don't want the anchor because the anchor will go sour. And it'll go sour when I'm in mid-ocean without any access to relief. and so on. It's a clean sweep. I know enough of it. And he, by this time, he was very cross and very unhelpful. And said, well, if you were to ask me to do that, I should refuse. I said, right, well, I'll go to my old family dentist. And I arranged to go down to Bath, which is where my old family dentist was, and without any difficulty at all, because he knew my mouth, and he knew that I had rotten teeth. And I arranged to have them all out. And that was that. But it was another, as it were, hiccup. And of course, there was I. It's always fun. I went in and said, now, before I leave the nursing home, I want to have my new dentist in and be able to eat a ginger biscuit. And he sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I don't know about that. And of course, I couldn't. And I was feeling a bit croaky, actually. But never mind. I had them out. And I won't return to that subject again. But although I had one or two slightly embarrassing incidents over the years, I never regretted it. And there we are. Well, then, the day came for the dress rehearsal. And the first Sea Lord, the Wee MacGregor, was going to attend this, which would end in a march past him. And I had to, I think it was the I think it was the day before or some such time. Anyway, at some stage I had to indicate to certainly the battalion commanders where they would start from and what the route was by way of briefing in the Clapham area. And I was having dinner with Ivan Sarrell, the chief staff officer, at his club the previous night. And I had, by this time, remarked all the West End, which is a long and tedious job, but I'd done it. And I was desperate to get hold of the Westminster City Council duty engineer to stop what would otherwise happen, which was that the water carts would come round and spray all the relevant streets to lay the dust and clean it up and all that sort of thing. And the risk was, of course, it would wash off my marks because they hadn't really set dry then. And I couldn't get hold of him. And he came on the phone to me, or I got on to him, and it was getting, it was 11 o'clock or plus. He said, well, I can't do anything about it because they've all gone out. And so I left Captain Sarrell and I leapt into my car and drove down to the area and had literally to physically go up to the water carts and say, turn round and go back home, you're not wanted tonight, and so forth, risking my all doing so. Well, it worked, and that was that. As a result of all that, it took quite a little time. We were into the small hours of the morning by then. And I thought, well, rather than going back to my digs, which were right up in old North London, where do all the Jews live?
Golders Green?
Golders Green, yes. It was up there where I'd found digs, which wasn't very convenient, but so that's another story. And rather than going back there, doubling the distance and so forth, I thought I'd drive down to Clapham and go into a side street and flake out in uniform because it was the morning of the dress rehearsal and so forth. And the mess didn't open until whatever it was, 7:30. I'd get some breakfast there and off we'd go. And this I did. And I got into my cul-de-sac, and it was a warm summer's evening, and I opened the window, took my cap off, pushed the seat back, and died. And some, not very long later, like half an hour or so. I woke up with a start, with a stiff neck and all the rest of it. And I was surrounded by police. And I looked up and sort of blinked, and there was the sergeant or whoever in charge. And he said, "Are you all right, sir?" And I said, "Yes, yes, fine, thank you. Are you sure you're all right, sir?" And I said, "Yes, quite." "What's the problem?" "Oh," said the sergeant, "well, we get quite a lot of stiffs around here, and we thought you were just another one." And that was the sort of area it was.
Yes. Can I ask, was it not possible to go to a club like the In-N-Out or the Army and Navy if it existed and just, or...?
Well, if you remember, I was a member of the senior, and you could only spend 5 consecutive nights there. And as a young lieutenant commander, you could ill afford that.
Right.
I mean, I'd done that to find digs, but only for that amount.
Right.
Because it was ruinous otherwise.
Okay.
Well, we got the dress rehearsal proceeded, except for the Royal Marines bands. And the Royal Marines senior bandmaster was an arrogant bit of work. He was only I think he was a captain, Royal Marines. And he hadn't really paid much attention, if indeed he'd been to the briefing meeting. And there came a point where the bands who were up ahead, they were leading the line, they should have wheeled right. And they didn't. They went straight on. And I legged it to the leading platoon, astern of the band, and just in time, they had to sort of go over grass and curbs and things, got them to wheel right, otherwise the whole lot would have gone the wrong way, and the whole thing would have been a massive flush. And I was livid. So I had words to say to the bandmaster on return.
Yes.
And that was that. But it was a very stupid performance. Well, I shift now to the the night before the actual coronation. And it was arranged that the brigade staff, that's the admiral, etc., and myself, should all sleep on board the headquarters ship Wellington alongside the embankment. And they were very good to us. And they invited us all to dinner the night before. And that was fine. And I'd been at great pains. One of the many problems was how to ensure, as far as possible, that those lining the route could stay lining it and weren't constantly in desperate need to go off for a pee, and where would they get one, because there were milling crowds and so forth. And apparently at the previous coronation, the jocular crowd, because you know how the public are on these occasions, where they sort of entered into the spirit of the thing, and they started to sing, "Here we come gathering nuts and may," and so forth. And I consulted the medical director general of the day, who was a very nice man and a wise virgin, and said, "What do we do about this?" And he said, "Oh, that's fairly straightforward as far as the men are concerned. You stop drinking 24 hours before." And I thought, right, and I put this in the orders, and I'd done so. And I said, then the other possible aspect is, what about the girls? Supposing they get caught short with their month then. And he went into excruciating detail about phenobarbitone, I think it was, that would stop them, but it would stop all other things and have side effects and so on and so forth. So we decided ultimately to drop that one and take a chance, and so forth. But we had no drink for 24 hours before, until our dinner in the Wellington. And it was easy enough to just get by and chat without a drink beforehand and during. And then they passed the port for the loyal toast. So we all had a sip of that, and that was it. And then on the morning of the coronation, we were supposed to fall in on the embankment at 6 o'clock. And it was bitterly cold that night. And there wasn't much heating in the Wellington. And I'd put on literally winter wools and the lot, and a brand new uniform suit that I'd never worn before. And it tipped with rain. And whereas the guards had cloaks, which were very practical actually, because they could cover the whole of themselves and their weaponry and their gorgeousness with the coats, the cloaks, the Navy, the sailor, only had oilskins and our officers' Burberrys and so forth. And we wore white webbing equipment, and that's another problem, because how did you protect that from wet weather if it was? Otherwise all the white would run. And if you went for plastic, which we weren't at all sure we could get procured in time, with age that would crack and it would go yellow. So it was a pretty nugatory expenditure, and we didn't go for it. But the performance of getting your main belt in white webbing to fit around you in ordinary day uniform, as opposed to you with an oilskin on, took quite a lot of juggling and so on. And I decided that nothing would look scruffier or worse than sailors in ill-fitting webbing equipment and oilskins, which are not exactly ceremonial garments, and so forth. And so I quickly passed word to the company commanders that we would not wear a foul weather rig. I didn't say why not, I just said we're not to wear it. And along came army lorries with all the oilskins embarked. And I went up to the staff sergeant in charge of the lead vehicle and said, a change of plan. The Navy is not going to wear oilskins. Now go. I don't mind where you go, but go. You can take the oilskin anywhere you like. At worst, take them back to barracks. But go now and do not stop. In case anybody tries to interfere with you, carry on going. And they went. And the next thing I knew was an army route marshal of major rank or so, storming down on a horse, of course, with a cloak and all the rest of it. And why weren't the Navy wearing their oilskins and that sort of thing? And I said, the Navy doesn't wear oilskins on ceremonial occasions, and they haven't turned up. And that was that. And of course, we all got soaked, absolutely soaked.
Did it actually rain through the day?
It did, through the day.
Right.
Well, there were a couple of other things. There were three parts to the ceremonial procession passing us. One was to the Abbey before the service. The other was from the Abbey after the service, and I forget what the third one was. I think it was because they went one way, e.g. Northumberland Avenue, to the Abbey, and another way up Whitehall from the Abbey, that sort of thing. And the brigade staff, the Rear Admiral and myself, etc., we positioned ourselves in Trafalgar Square. And all we had to do was move half a dozen paces or so, facing this way or facing that way, and that was easy. To which end, I had taken the others into the Admiralty Quadrangle for half an hour's sword drill, which they weren't accustomed to beforehand. And we therefore had half an hour's training for this. Everybody else had something like 3 weeks or so. And that was interesting. And while we were in, I think it was the Front procession, and it was still tipping with rain. No, it was the Two procession, that's right. The whole procession came to a grinding halt. And it really was pissing with rain. And in one coach, which the whole thing came to a grinding halt. I don't know why to this day, but it did. And directly opposite us was a coach containing the Queen of the Tonga, Queen Salote, an enormous figure. And sitting opposite her was the Sultan of Kelantan or whoever, a tiny little man. And while the coach stopped, just before us, it's fascinating, the Sultan fished in his pocket and brought out a handkerchief and started to mop his face. And a great black fist, the size of a leg of mutton from Queen Salete, just leant forward and knocked it sideways and tried to get stuffed. And that was that. And then on the Front procession, just as the naval senior cavalcade, headed by the First Sea Lord, was about to go through Admiralty Arch,